Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As we observe Veterans Day, with the military establishment still stunned by the downfall of General Petraeus, we'll begin with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tom Ricks, whose new book just out is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. We'll discuss the gulf between performance and accountability within the highest ranks of the military as the 11th commander in 11 years takes charge of the current war in Afghanistan. Then, following the abrupt departure of General Petraeus, we'll look into the leadership shuffle at the CIA with the former 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern. We'll discuss the difficulties the Obama White House have had in establishing an intelligence team, starting with the first director of National Intelligence Council, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who was ousted on his first day on the job. Then finally, as the Syrian conflict shows signs of spreading with Israeli tanks returning fire against artillery on the Golan Heights, we will examine the newly formed Syrian opposition coalition headed by a prominent Sunni imam. James Galvin, an expert on Syria at UCLA, joins us to describe the makeup of this new coalition that is more likely to receive increased funding and arms as the military stalemate in Syria drags on. And joining us now in the studio is Thomas Ricks, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, who has reported on military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He writes a blog at foreignpolicy.com, lectures widely to the military, is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is a member of the Harvard University Senior Advisory Council on the Project on U.S. Civil-Military Relations. His books include the best-selling Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, its follow-up, The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008, and his latest book just out is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ricks.
Thank you.
And your book, of course, couldn't be on a hotter topic in terms of the focus now on the downfall of not just a regular American general, but somebody that has been idolized, portrayed as both a great warrior and a great intellect. You've known him for some time, and the woman involved as well. What's your personal feeling then about his downfall?
The last chapter in the book, The Generals, is about General Petraeus. I've known him for about 15 years. I've known Paula Broadwell, his alleged lover, for I think 4 or 5 years. My personal feeling is, first, I was shocked. The last general I thought would do this would be Dave Petraeus, partly because he had been so focused, so ambitious, so determined in his life to be not only a general but a great general, a great captain of the military. For him to slip this way is quite surprising to me. That said, you put a guy out, 3 combat tours in Iraq, another combat tour in Afghanistan, a lot of other time out in the field. He's going to slip eventually. I mean, people have more sex in prison than, you know, some guy doing 5 combat tours. It bothers me and it worries me about what it says more about the nation than what it says about General Petraeus. First, that somebody who has given so generously of his time and his family has given receives, when the time comes, so little generosity from us, so little forgiveness from us. Second, and this angers me, why the hell do we care more about somebody's personal sex life than his public competence? We have a lot of mediocre generals who keep their pants on. I'd much rather have a really good general who might occasionally like a roll in the hay. And the funny thing is, historically, that's been true. We have not always been so hypocritically puritanical in our judgment of our military leaders. In World War II, Dwight Eisenhower pretty openly carried on with his beautiful red-haired British driver, Kay Summersby. Yet he wasn't fired on the eve of D-Day, told, sure, some soldiers are going to get killed, but you got to go home because you didn't keep your pants on. Likewise, in the Korean War, Matthew Ridgway, another great general, turned the war around early in 1951. Also had a reputation of a womanizer. In fact, seemed to get a new wife for each war. When I was researching the generals, I would be in the military archives looking through his personal papers among other generals. And a lot of these papers are about how do you get better commanders in Iraq? How do we do – I mean, I'm sorry, how do you get better commanders in Korea where he's leading during the war? How do we fix this war? Interspersed with all those military documents, there are occasionally terse notes from his first wife's divorce lawyer. We seem less tolerant of that these days. We seem so permissive when it comes to public execution of one's duties. You want to be a mediocre general? Not a problem. But we are so exacting about private behavior. It's almost like becoming a general these days is like a university professor with tenure. Nobody cares if you're lousy at your job, but if you embarrass the institution, then you got to go. So bottom line is the news flash this week, we found out David Petraeus is human.
Well, you know, the gold standard in your book, The Generals, of course, is General Marshall. And he counseled Eisenhower when he was thinking of leaving Mamie for K. Summersby. Mm-hmm. And General Marshall basically said, you know, straighten up and
straighten
fly
up
right.
And fly right. And he said it also because he said, Ike, you don't understand how important you're going to be in post-war Europe. You can't just go and retire now. We are going to have to hold together this shattered continent. And you're going to be the American face of that. And if you overthrow your wife and marry the driver you've been boffing, that's not going to work. And so he basically gave him a good talking to and sent him back out in the field. And Eisenhower, who could be a very cold man, followed his orders and cut off Kay Summersby without another word.
So Tom Ricks, again, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post. His latest book is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Now, in terms of this gulf between performance and accountability, which is very much what your book reveals, I was always struck by the similarities in a way between Westmoreland of Vietnam and Tommy Franks of Iraq, in as much as they both came out of artillery. And mm-hmm. and so what does that say?
It's actually a good observation and not one I expect on Pacifica Radio.
Well, yeah, I'm the token right winger here.
It's funny. That's what my parents used to say when I covered the military for the Wall Street Journal. He covers fascists for a fascist newspaper. It's an astute observation. When Westmoreland was sent to Vietnam, there were concerns and objections inside the Army at the time. This is an infantryman's war. You need an infantryman, someone who knows about being out on the patrol, rather than somebody whose specialty is the deliverer of firepower at a distance. And I think that did skew the way we fought that war. Tommy Franks, similarly, big believer in firepower and probably the low point of modern American generalship. I want to point out, though, something that really struck me in writing the book. Tommy Franks was not an aberration, was not an anomaly. He was exactly what the U.S. Army was trying to produce. Very tactically oriented, a guy focused on combat, focused on the first battle, the first day of a war, and really quite good at the first day of battle. Clueless about what to do to end the war.
He succeeded in losing two wars, right?
Yeah, most generals.
He let bin Laden go. And how much do you hold him accountable for that? I mean, I thought that was Rumsfeld's call.
No, I think quite a lot, Tommy Franks. Part of the job of generals is to push back on civilians when necessary. I think Tommy Franks was intimidated by Donald Rumsfeld, who could be quite a bully. But hey, Tommy Franks was a four-star general. There's a reason you have those four stars. That's the level at which you talk back politely, respectfully, and candidly to civilians, which was the great skill of George Marshall with Franklin Roosevelt. The reason Marshall was picked by Roosevelt to lead the army is because he spoke truth to power. When he needed to say what he thought to Roosevelt, he did. He didn't just salute. So Tommy Franks is a unique figure that I can, as far as I can tell in our history, most generals get a chance to screw up one war. Tommy Franks screwed up two. In Afghanistan, yeah, he pushes bin Laden and al-Qaeda into Pakistan. Now, let's see. We're going from Afghanistan, a small, unstable Muslim country, to Pakistan, a big, unstable Muslim country with nuclear weapons. Is this a good idea, General Franks? I don't think so. He does it twice. First at Tora Bora in late 01, and then again in Operation Anaconda in the spring of 02. But we're not finished. Then he goes to Iraq and does the same thing he did in Afghanistan. I take the enemy capital, and then I say, I've won, and I leave. In both cases, in Kabul and in Baghdad, that was not when the war ended. It's when it began.
Right. Quick victory followed by a slow defeat.
Yeah. And a belief that somehow it wasn't his problem, which is actually the key job of a general, to connect the military action to the political outcome. This is basic Clausewitz, but he thought it wasn't his job. So effectively, Tommy Franks was a jumped-up battalion commander who knew how to lead a battalion but not how to lead a war.
So again, Tom Ricks, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, his latest book, The General's American Military Command from World War II to Today. The 11th general now, in the 11th year of the Afghan war. And of course, Petraeus was the architect of counterinsurgency, and there were others who were pushing counterterrorism, I think led largely by Joe Biden. What's your analysis of that? That seems to be essentially all a waste of time, money, manpower. I mean, what do we have to show for that extra so-called surge in the 11th? This is the longest war, after all.
Yeah. The surge in Iraq had a purpose that it achieved, which is to get us out of Iraq. In Afghanistan, we have not succeeded, and I'm hearing pretty worrisome things about Afghanistan. That said, in the long run, and I lived in Afghanistan as a kid, I know the country. I am more optimistic about Afghanistan than I am about Iraq, partly because I think Afghans still have a sense of a country that I don't see when I talk to Iraqis. Iraqis are really split and stalemated along ethnic and sectarian lines.
So in other words, we broke that country. That's what Colin Powell warned, didn't he? If you break it, you own it.
Well, but we don't own it.
Exactly. That's the point.
We broke it and the Iranians collected. We knocked down the wall that really was the bulwark against Iranian expansion westward. I think we may have a new axis of evil emerging. Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan. So a country that we thought we conquered, a country we thought was an ally, lining up with the country that we keep on saying is so terrible, Iran, and we're getting Syria in the bargain. This is not a net gain in the Middle East for us. Yes, at the expense of thousands of American lives, tens of thousands of Iraqi lives, and billions upon billions of dollars. But I want to go back to one thing you mentioned, 11 commanders in 11 years in Afghanistan. This really bothers me. A friend of mine, Andrew Exum, who fought in Afghanistan as an army officer, wrote recently about the casual arrogance with which we have fought our wars. And I think that's a really telling phrase. And 11 commanders in 11 years really brings that home. The thought that we can go and just rotate our commanders mindlessly, 11 commanders in 11 years. If you had 11 CEOs of a corporation in 11 years, it would collapse. Yet we somehow think we can put guys in and they can figure it out and run the war and leave. It reminds me of something Warren Buffett once said. I'm not sure we're allowed to quote Warren Buffett on Pacifica, but I will anyways. Warren Buffett once said, if you've been playing poker for half an hour and you don't know who the patsy at the table is, you're the patsy. When we put a new commander out in Afghanistan every year, we are making him the patsy. Everybody else knows where all the bodies are buried, what's in the closet, what's the secret agenda of somebody. He's still figuring it out. And when he's just about figured it out, he leaves. I actually had a friend who was a Marine officer, a Marine intelligence officer in Afghanistan. At the end of 1 year, he said to his command chain of command, you know, I'm beginning just to figure this thing out. I'd like to stay for another year. And the response was no, it's someone else's turn.
So this is what they used to call ticket punching. Is that still going on?
Yeah, it's also this mindless way that sort of the bureaucratic military runs. Oh, we're just going to rotate everybody in like they're interchangeable pieces. And we're not really going to judge anybody on their performance. So you don't see officers who are successful promoted quickly. You don't see mediocre officers chastened and told to do better. And you don't see lousy officers having consequences for their career. The military just marches on and on. Now, Defense Secretary Robert Gates tried to address that. He actually called General Petraeus back from Iraq during wartime, it was unprecedented, to run a promotion board for new Army Brigadier Generals. And Petraeus really picked a different set of generals. Intelligent people who could think critically and had demonstrated effective combat leadership.
So the army is not, or the military is not the meritocracy that as advertised.
I don't think it is. And I don't want to hit on the military too much here. The army is a great, diverse institution that does better with race and drug issues than any other major American institution I can think of. The frontline soldier is well-trained, well-equipped, and operates in a cohesive unit. And these are all good things to have. Yet we do not give our troops the leadership they deserve. We have confused, I think, in our reaction to Vietnam, supporting the troops with supporting generals. One way to support the troops is to question the generals, to push them. But I think as a nation, we're no longer equipped to do that.
Oh, our congressmen all the time say, slavishly defer to generals.
And they say, I support the troops and so on. Yeah. Congressman, you want to support the troops, learn about the military, learn to ask questions. Mm-hmm. As late as the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the Congress had military experience. Today, two-thirds do not, and it's going down. The same is true in the media, lack of military experience. The same is true in American public life generally. And I think we no longer know how to judge military competence. Now, we all think we're experts on sex and morality, so we feel perfectly free to judge people on that. That may be one reason that we give people a pass on professional competence, but judge them severely on their personal lives. And I think it's frankly disgusting.
Again, Tom Ricks, the author of the new book, The General's American Military Command from World War II to Today. Just in the last couple of minutes, then you mentioned, we talked about General Marshall during World War II and how he would speak truth to power and to FDR, his commander-in-chief. That's sorely lacking. Obviously, there's we have civilian control over the military, which is clearly a good thing. But when you look at George W. Bush, talk about casual arrogance. I mean, and the neocons that beguiled him into that war. I mean, I know Brent Scowcroft tried to talk sense to them, but they froze him out. You feel like you wish that some of those guys, and there was somebody else there, not Tommy Franks. Actually, there was Shinseki. At least he tried to tell the truth, didn't he?
General Shinseki did. He was Army Chief of Staff, and he said, we don't have enough troops in the invasion force. That's exactly the type of moment at which FDR and Marshall would have said, okay, time out here. Let's examine that. And that goes to the root of good civil military discourse. What you want is discussions between the civilian leaders and the top military that say, what are our assumptions and what are our differences? Let's examine and explore them. For example, assumption of Vietnam, that Hanoi would have a breaking point before the Americans did. Never examined. Turned out it was wrong. Assumption of the 1991 Gulf War. If we give Saddam Hussein a good thumping, he will fall from power. Again, an assumption that was unexamined and turned out to be wrong. Marshall and FDR and the people around them really sat down and examined their assumptions, and they explored their differences, painful though it might be. Good civil military relations doesn't mean everybody gets along chummy. Sure. Sometimes it means you get real anger and blood on the table, but you don't want to shy away from it. You want to take this very seriously. Another thing I liked about Marshall and his dealings with Roosevelt, he was not at all social with him. Once Roosevelt addressed Marshall as George, and Marshall made it clear that he preferred to be called General Marshall. He didn't like to dine with FDR. He didn't laugh at his jokes. The first time he ever visited the president's home at Hyde Park was for Roosevelt's funeral.
And of course, the fundamental difference here is that the World War II, the Japanese attacked at Pearl Harbor. The Iraq War was a war of choice. So the real advice would have been, which is what Scowcroft tried to do, was to say, don't do it in the first place.
And the role of the military at that point, it would have been to say, sir, we will execute your orders. But before you do, have you considered this? Why are you doing this? As far as I know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, Richard Meyer, never said to Rumsfeld or the president, what do you think you're doing here? Why do you think you're doing? What are the consequences going to be? And I'm sorry, that's hard to do when you're talking to your boss. That's the job. Okay. And he didn't do it. In fact, I would say that's a moral collapse of the role of the top military officer.
Well, Tom Ricks, we could talk on here for a while, but we've run out of time. And I thank you for joining us here today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Ricks, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post, who has reported on military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He writes a blog at foreignpolicy.com, lectures widely to the military, and is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is a member of the Harvard University Senior Advisory Council on the Project on U.S. Military U.S. Civil-Military Relations. His books include the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, its follow-up, The Gamble, General David Petraeus, and The American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. And his latest book just out is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the leadership shuffle at the top of the CIA.
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under seven U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefing at the White House to many of them. He currently leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. In 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war in Iraq, or on Iraq, and his latest article at Consortium News is Pundit Tears for Petraeus' Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Ian.
And Ray, the Obama White House has actually had trouble establishing an intelligence team, starting with its first director of the National Intelligence Council, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who was ousted on the first day on the job. And we're told that Petraeus was finally sort of settling into the job, and now he's gone. What's your sense of this, you know, this continual shuffle in terms of President Obama's ability to get a team together?
Well, I think each case, Ian, is sui generis here. Petraeus is indeed an exceptional case. What's really interesting these days is how not only establishment Washington in the officialdom, but the top pundits reveal themselves to have been smitten, as much smitten by Petraeus as his mistress or his ex-mistress. It's really quite remarkable. Everything that your previous interviewee said about the top military is true. There is a moral collapse. And Richard Meyer was not the only one. Now, I'm not talking about sexual indiscretions. I'm talking about knowing better and pursuing god-awful, feckless wars that deserve the label of really strange escapades. And Petraeus is smart enough to have known that the adventure in Iraq, and particularly the adventure in Afghanistan, was a fool's errand. Okay? Now, why do I say that? Well, here we have the famous strategist, right? And he has big ideas. Columnist David Ignatius ran several rings chimes on this theme about how great a strategist and how he did great things. But you know what? If you forget the fundamentals, if you forget the fundamentals of an infantry officer, which we learned in the early 60s, maybe it was missing from the curriculum in West Point toward the later 60s. But, you know, there were certain things you took into account before you launched any kind of expedition, whether it was a squad attack or whether it was a division. Now, this sounds corny, but we were taught to memorize an estimate of the situation because it had five key points. What about the enemy? How many are there? Where are they? What kinds of weapons do they have? What kind of weather is there going to be? How about the terrain? Is it really true that if you flattened Afghanistan, you'd have a country as big as China? And last, but by no means least, lox. Okay, now I'm from New York, but I'm not talking about bagels and lox. I'm talking about lines of communication and supply. And for any second lieutenant, much less three-star general, to recommend that we ship tons of equipment and personnel from the West Coast to Karachi to be downloaded or offloaded on trains and trucks and taken up the length of Pakistan, which is not all very friendly territory, over the Hindu Kush into Afghanistan, and consider that you have reliable lines of communication, that is gross misfeasance. And Petraeus should have known that. And we could see what it's costing to put a gallon of gas in a Marine tank in Afghanistan, and we could see how vulnerable those lines are. In other words, you can't get there from here, not without being beholden to the Pakistanis, not without being cut off by the Pakistanis, as we were for several months. So what I'm saying here is that Petraeus was looking at his own advancement, and it's very clear that he does not deserve the wonderful embellished reputation that he's earned. I'd like to add one more thing before I forget. There's all this talk about the surge, right? The famous surge in 2007, which is credited with turning the Iraq war around. Let me comment on that. Your previous interviewee said the surge was designed to get us out of Iraq. Wrong. And he should know better. I think he does know better. The surge was designed to let Bush and Cheney exit the scene without having lost a definitive war. In the fall of 2006, in September, General Casey, General Abizaid came back and testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and what they said was, please, we really appreciate your thought, but please don't send any more troops. For Pete's sake, if you send more troops, what's going to happen is the Iraqi generals and the Iraqi politicians will never get it through their head that they have to make deals, that they have to take over their own government and take responsibility. So please, whatever you do, no more troops. Now, what happens? Bush and Cheney go to the think tanks that they consort with, and they say, what happens if we don't send any more troops? And the answer is, you lose a war on your watch. That's why Bush called Bobby Gates out of mothballs and said, Bobby, we have a general who's willing to surge troops in there to prevent a loss. And the upshot of that was, Ian, very simple, okay? There were 33,000 more troops sent in around Baghdad. And those troops ensured that the city of Baghdad, of 5 or 6 million people, was turned from a predominantly Sunni city into a predominantly Shia city. Now, that took a lot. You can watch the satellite photographs, the lights going out in the Shia neighborhoods. It was ethnic cleansing by any stretch of the definition, and that's why, after we lost almost 1,000 more people through the surge, that's why the battles went down a little, because the Shia and the Sunni were not living in close proximity anymore. The upshot of that, of course, is 4 million Iraqis displaced from their homes, 2 million in neighboring countries, and 2 million internal refugees. Now, that's not anything to be proud of. The reason we're not still there is because we were kicked out. And who has the predominant influence there? Well, Iran. So that was a fool's errand. Petraeus was part of that thing. And Petraeus turned a blind eye to a lot of things, including Iraqi-on-Iraqi torture. It was during the surge that famous attack by the Apache helicopter on the two Reuters correspondents and 10 other men, killing them in Baghdad. It was during the surge that was done. And all kinds of things like that were done, given the testimony of the people that came back from Iraq. They had the helicopter gunships. They were looking for targets, and so they found them. So in a direct sense here, we're talking about Bradley Manning, the fellow who apparently gave the WikiLeaks trove of information to Julian Assange, including this collateral murder video. Well, he did that because he witnessed personally the fact that young Iraqi students, his age, were writing critical things of Maliki and other leading Iraqi politicians. They were wrapped up and they were thrown in these jails where he knew, where everyone knew, that Iraqis were torturing these people. And thankfully, in my view, Bradley Manning had a conscience. And he went to his superiors. He said, you know, these kids, all they did was write a memo here or a term paper, for God's sake. They shouldn't be tortured. And he said, oh, shut up, go home, complete your tour. And his conscience wouldn't let him do that. So my point simply is that all kinds of abuses came along with this famous surge. And it did not reverse the tide of the battle. It just postponed our real sorrowful retreat out of that country when they told us we couldn't stay any longer. And look at it today. It's much worse than when we invaded it. So Petraeus played a big role in that. And on Afghanistan, I just can't believe his reputation. What did he say? When he came back and testified, he said, well, we're making progress, but it's fragile and it's reversible. And what we really need is a political deal. Now, Eikenberry, the ambassador there, who also was a former general, he told the president, ain't no way Karzai would be a decent partner in any of this. So the idea of building a government, much less a government in a box that they were going to put in Narja and in Kandahar, it was all a crock. And, you know, unless you say Petraeus is dumb, which I don't think he's dumb, you have to say that it was unconscionable. Unconscionable, the way he threw these young boys from the inner city and from the small towns of our country into the fray for this surge, at which cost 1,000 extra U.S. troops. So the surge is a really, really bad myth that has been bruited about by the establishment here in Washington. I'm sorry to hear your previous speakers say that it was to get out of Iraq. No, it was to stay in Iraq until Bush and Cheney was safely out of Washington. That's what it was for.
Again, I'm speaking with Ray McGovern, retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under 7 U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House to many of them. Now, Ray, back to the CIA, and this was a job, of course, that in his testimony, Petraeus said he wanted. I mentioned that Chaz Freeman, who's one of the most talented intelligent people in the U.S. government, I've spoken to him a number of times, and he's just one of the most exemplary people you could ever wish to have in a job. He got driven out of there on his first day by the Israeli lobby, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Brennan, who's an eminence grise there at the White House, he was Tenet's right hand guy. Tenet himself was a PR flack. He wasn't a real intelligence officer. So pretty slim pickings. Is there ever going to be anybody of the stature of a Chaz Freeman that's a kind of Renaissance man with diplomatic and intelligence and language skills? He speaks Arabic and Chinese, for example. Anybody like that that's going to be tapped?
Well, that is my hope, of course. It's hard to know. What Obama needs to do, in my view, is to realize he's got a real mandate here. He doesn't have to pay attention to all the folks that he had to pay attention to during his first term. The election is won, and it was won decidedly. So he has the option, and particularly now, with the disappearance of Petraeus, and, you know, I think the White House was just as happy to see him go. You know, he created this sort of other power base there, which was very much in tune with the neoconservatives, who were responsible for Iraq, responsible for lots of stuff that goes on there, and who were peopling the team of Romney. So without Petraeus there, there's what is absent is a great big rooter for the Israeli stand against Iran. And there's copious evidence of that, the most recent of which was on the 31st of January of this year, when the top intelligence officials presented the annual worldwide threat briefing to the Congress. General Clapper, or James Clapper now, the head of national intelligence, told it like it is. I was so proud. He said, yeah, as we've been saying for 5 years now, Iran has not decided yet to build a nuclear weapon. Whoa! That means they're not building a nuclear weapon in my English. Now, what did Petraeus say? Well, Iran is a existential threat to Israel. He said it twice. Now, why would he say that? Well, to curry favor with the neocons with whom he's so allied. Now, why is that supremely ironic? Well, it's supremely ironic because 1 week before he said that, he met with the head of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence sure. organization, who said, you know, this existential threat, that Iran's no existential threat to us. And he said that publicly.
Sure. Well, Ray, I'm afraid we're out of time. I mean, I'm sorry to do this, but...
No problem. Well, it's, you know, it's really interesting how these smitten pundits and writers and all think Petraeus was some sort of hero when I, as you see in my article, I think the word charlatan is more appropriate.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Ray McGovern.
Most welcome.
Again, Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under seven U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them. He has an article at Consortium News, Pundit Tears for Petraeus' Fall. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the newly formed Coalition of Syrian Opposition. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, a History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And there have been meetings in the Gulf in Doha that have concluded with a newly organized National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, headed by Moaz al-Hatib, who is a former imam of the big mosque in Damascus. The opposition, of course, in Syria have been notoriously fractured. And lately, I understand the New York Times carried a story recently saying that they were getting more and more unpopular within Syria itself because of the excesses of some of the Salafists, the so-called al-Qaeda types, executing prisoners, etc. What is this new organized opposition likely to achieve, do you think?
Well, the most important thing, and the reason why Hillary Clinton demanded that it form, was that it's going to replace the Syrian National Council, which the United States has always viewed as unrepresentative of the opposition. There's several problems with the Syrian National Council that this new group is intended to fix, one of which a vast majority of its members were in exile, and many hadn't been back in Syria for years. Secondly, there was really no connection between the civilian leadership of the Syrian National Council and the military leadership on the ground. And this is a real problem right now in particular, because over the last year or so, the rebellion has become increasingly militarized. So the civilian components of the opposition are being or have been shoved aside. Now they will be represented. Now the military will be represented along with the civilians. This will allow the West, the United States, the Western allies, but also Saudi Arabia and Qatar, to funnel aid directly into the opposition, as opposed to the way they had been doing it before, which was, first of all, covertly on the part of the West, but also in terms of each country, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, focusing in on those members of the opposition that it particularly enjoyed warm relationships with to the exclusion of others. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it was the Salafis. In the case of Qatar, it was the Muslim Brotherhood.
So what's happening, though, with Syria in terms of there were some mortars fired in the Golan Heights into Israel, and Israel retaliated. And there also there was an airstrike the Syrian Air Force struck very close to the Turkish border. Is Assad trying to, bring in foreign powers? Because he's been saying his excuse for what he's doing is that he's fighting a war against foreign intervention when there's no evidence that that's the case. Is he trying to create evidence of foreign intervention?
Well, we don't know exactly what's going on in the heads of the people who are right now running Syria. I would very much doubt that they do want to get into some sort of large-scale conflict, for example, over the Golan Heights. They also undoubtedly do not want to take on the Turks by themselves either. The question is how, well, the issue that's being raised is whether or not these provocations are being made so that there would be, let's say, some form of counterstrike to unite Syrians against Assad, against either the Turks or the Israelis. I'm not really buying that. I think that perhaps the professionalism of the Syrian military is probably overestimated. The centralization of the Syrian military is overestimated as well. Local unit commanders, the ones that are trusted, of course, have more of a say in what they're going to do against the opposition than it's first apparent. So it's very possible that what's going on are local operatives, mistakes that are being made, or perhaps even the possibility of the opposition itself trying to create a larger conflict.
But I imagine neither the Israelis or the Turks are reflexive enough to be baited into responding.
Well, the Israelis have already responded, of course.
With
they
artillery.
Knocked out an artillery position after a second day of mortar rounds being fired over the border. So it's one of those things that I don't think there's going to be a dramatic escalation. And what I found very surprising so far is the way the Turks have stood down after provocation in particular. But I don't think there's going to be large-scale confrontation between either Turkey and Syria or Israel and Syria.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA, where he specializes in Greater Syria, and he's the author of The Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. I mentioned, James, the New York Times recently carried a fairly sobering story of how the Syrian people, who obviously would like to get rid of the dictator, at the same time they're afraid of chaos, and we're told that it's not just the Alawites that support the regime, but also the Christians as well. But apparently there's been some revulsion against some of the tactics on the part of some of the elements of the so-called Free Syrian Army, particularly the Salafist elements who executed captured soldiers. What's your understanding of how the Syrian people are viewing the opposition or the uprising or the rebels or whatever you want to call them?
Well, I think it's important to just step back a second and look at how the regime has ruled in Syria. One of the things that they've employed has been what the Arab Human Development reports call the legitimacy of blackmail. It's actually legitimacy by blackmail. And what they basically do is they tell their populations, their supporters in the population, which their natural supporters would be religious minorities, such as the Alawites, who make up predominantly the ruling group, and Christians as well, but also Druzes and Kurds and what have you, that if we go, you're in real serious trouble. You're going to be wiped out completely. They've played this card on multiple occasions. They're not the only ones, by the way, in the Middle East that do that. The Bahrainis have done it, and even the Egyptians have done it in terms of their own Christian population. So the regime itself has completely played the sectarian card and upped the ante at several points by calling the opposition, all of the opposition Salafists, by calling all of the opposition members of the Muslim Brotherhood terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. They not only militarized the conflict, the government not only militarized the conflict, the government also sectarianized the conflict. It made it into a sectarian dispute by calling out the opposition as members of Islamist organizations, by accusing them of being Salafis, and by seeking support, hoping that the minority communities would circle their wagons around the regime. As a result, we see the situation that we have now. For example, the sectarianization began with Alawite militias known as Shabiha, who deliberately massacred villages that were predominantly Sunni or entirely Sunni. Then what you get was, of course, tit-for-tat retaliation back and forth. Then, of course, there's been the infiltration into Syria, mainly from Iraq, but from other places as well, of a variety of jihadis. There is an indigenous jihadi movement, the Jabhat Nusra, but there's also probably fighters who got their training elsewhere who have infiltrated back into Syria. So what we see right now is a very, very sectarianized situation. So it's not surprising that people would look at the fighters and say, my God, you know, they're committing as many crimes as the government. Why won't they just give it up? There's something in addition to that, though. The tactics that have been used, not just the killings, but the tactics, overall tactics that have been used by the opposition has led to its declining or less popularity than you would expect. What they do is they go into sections of cities, they take over sections of cities, they have no chance of holding territory, but then the government comes in and levels those sections of cities. And we've seen this, for example, in various parts of Aleppo, in the main souk in Damascus. The business people in that souk, who are mainly Sunni Muslims, begged the opposition not to go into the souk, not to take over the souk, not to attempt to fight for the souk, simply because they feared that this was exactly what was going to happen there. So it's a combination of sectarianization and also the tactics that are used that have diminished the popularity of the opposition.
So when the new leader of this opposition umbrella group, the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, that was unveiled on Sunday in Doha, the leader, the former imam, Mr. Hatib, he says, we demand freedom for every Sunni, Alawite, Ismaili, Christian, Druze, Assyrian, and the rights of all parts of the harmonious Syrian people. What's his rhetoric likely to do in terms of what you just said with the war-weary, paranoid people who've witnessed the destruction of one of the great wonders of the world, the souk in Aleppo, and this tactic of going into territories, taking areas and then having them pulverized by the Syrian military, which in turn makes them unpopular with the very people that they're trying to liberate?
The rhetoric has a nice cooling effect. I'm not quite sure it's going to have any real effect on the ground, though. I think what's more important, though, is by putting somebody like this on top, and he's very well respected. The position, first of all, of Imam at the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus is a very important symbolic position, and he's very well respected in Syria. By putting somebody like this in charge, and then by having, for example, his vice president being somebody who actually performed heroically during the brief Damascus spring of 2000, and then a member of the Atassi family, who a woman, as a matter of fact, as another vice president, maybe even a Kurd, this gives the impression of a overall umbrella group that's very inclusive. And this will allow the West to actually funnel in the sort of assistance that these people have been asking for. By doing that, what it'll allow the West to do is to target the assistance to those groupings that they think will be more malleable towards Western ideals. That is, not the jihadis, not the al-Qaeda people, et cetera, et cetera.
So is this likely, though, this new group with this imam that Ali regarded at the head of it, will the Syrian people, given the nature of state media propaganda, where are they getting the information from? Are they aware of this change? That, and is it something that they're all going to understand and perhaps rally behind?
Well, the question is whether or not they're going to get the information is a fairly simple answer to that. Yes, they will, of course. The regime does not have a completely effective control over the propaganda. I mean, every time I visit friends in Syria, they they've listened to Voice of America and they've listened to Radio Israel and various other stations as well. Whether they believe it or not is another question. But they do have access to information in Syria. And, of course, now with the new social media as well, electronic media, there is more and more access, including Al Jazeera. So the access is certainly there. The question is, what are people going to do with the information once they get it? Now, there is a possibility that it'll work itself out in the following way. If money gets funneled in through this group, groups that are want to get hold of that money or the arms or the non-lethal aid that's going to be filtered in through it are going to have to submerge themselves within this group as well. So what this means is that there's going to be a premium on joining this group, and this might allow it to succeed. The problem is that the political ambitions of this group are not well known. We don't really know what the overall program is. We do know that the formation of this group has made it so there will be no political solution to what's going on in Syria. They have already stated that they are not, that one of the fundamental objectives of this group is not to hold a national dialogue with Assad, which means that the only way that this thing can be resolved now is going to be through military.
Well, the Russians, of course, James Galvin, are insisting on a negotiated settlement. And if that's a non-starter, I noticed that the Chinese, who had an observer at the meetings in Doha, they seem to be moderating their position and they're not quite as pro-Assad as the Russians are. Is that a correct reading of that?
I think that what we have to do is step back and look at under what conditions a political settlement would be possible. And I'm not ruling out entirely a political settlement, but what I am ruling out is a political settlement being likely. And there's a reason for that. There are two conditions that have to be met before there can be a political solution. The opposition and Assad have to simultaneously see the situation as being stalemated, that they can't possibly make an end run militarily or any other way, and they have to start talking to the opposition. To the opposition or to the government. That's number one. Second precondition is at the very same time, outside powers, United States, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, have to view the situation also as stalemated and also have to stop viewing Syria as a zero-sum game, where a loss for Iran, for example, would be a win for Saudi Arabia or vice versa. What that means, of course, is that they would not at that point pump in more weapons to their side that they think is going to win, but instead push their side towards a negotiated settlement. These two conditions, that everybody on the ground inside Syria views it as a stalemate, everybody outside views it as a stalemate also, are highly unlikely to be met.
So just in terms of the stalemate and the agony of 36,000 people being killed, that's the official statistic. I think you have to add to that all of the people that were arrested. If you've been disappeared by the Assad regime into the Muhabarat's prison system, I don't think you're going to come out, are you?
There has been a revolving door. Part of the way they actually do this thing is, as Lenin once said, the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize. I have a friend, for example, who was arrested by the government several years ago taken to a prison, actually in a very nice residential area, the prison was in Damascus, tortured, lost all of his hair, had scars, and then he was released. And he wanted to know from the prison officials what, you know, what he can and cannot say so he wouldn't be swept up again. And they said, tell him everything. We don't care. You know, let him know. So that's the whole idea behind, you know, these mass arrests, et cetera. But let me add to the bleak picture. Before the uprising began, there was about 1.3 million internal refugees, people who came from the countryside into cities because the Syrian economy is highly dependent upon agriculture, and it hadn't rained in Syria for 4 years straight. Okay, so you had mass population movements taking place. Now, add in another 1.5 million people. So we're up above, you know, 10% of the population here that are internally displaced refugees. United Nations numbers are anywhere between 400,000 and 500,000 external refugees on top of this. The Syrian economy is a mess, particularly after the 17 rounds of EU sanctions, for example. So it's a very, very bleak picture about the way Syria is going to emerge from this confrontation.
Well, just in closing, James Galvin, the British and the French have indicated that they may consider arming the opposition, and clearly they've been outgunned by the Syrian military, and it's pretty obvious that they haven't been getting much in the way of sophisticated weaponry, particularly anti-aircraft weaponry. Is that going to change?
That I can't tell you. I don't know exactly what's going on in the councils. I would assume that that probably will change, considering the sort of tactics that the government has been using, which has been, frankly, they don't do house-to-house combat. What they do is they bomb from the air or shell from the ground whole districts of cities that have been taken over by the opposition. So it's very, very possible that a tilt would have to include anti-aircraft or even anti-missile batteries.
Well, my understanding from field investigator for Amnesty International, who has made several trips inside of Syria, she was telling me recently that the Syrian government's tactic is that all of the liberated area, they shell randomly just to terrorize the population and punish them for accepting the rebels.
Right, exactly. And there's something else that's involved in this as well. Like, for example, if you remember the Battle of Bab Amru in Homs, took place last year, shelled the district, destroyed it. It had been a predominantly Sunni district. Now what they're doing, what the government is doing, is they're rebuilding it, and they're making it into an Alawite district within the city itself. In other words, what the government is doing is deliberately sectarianizing space within Syria.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.